So, one of the simplest instructions for meditation or for living a Buddhist life goes like this. Set yourself at ease. Set yourself at ease, whatever ease you can set yourself at. So it's a matter of degree, right? I mean, if you're agitated, maybe it would just be a little bit easy about being agitated. Or if you're, you know, there's all kinds of what, you know, it can be big, it can be small, but do what you can to set yourself at ease. And then notice what takes you away from that. That's it. Isn't that great? Set yourself at ease and then notice what takes you away from that. And notice what takes you away from that, I think, implies study it, look into it, get to know it really well. What are the forces, what are the tendencies of your mind to get agitated, to get contracted, to get afraid, to get, you know, to suffer around what's going on. And there's the wonderful aspect of this kind of instruction is that it's going to apply in so many different places in your life. Set yourself at ease when you get into your car to drive someplace. And then notice when you lose that ease. You take a moment to sit there and before you even turn the engine on. And then notice at what point in your driving do you lose that ease and why do you lose it? What's the forces for it? Is it because of all those other drivers out there? Or is it because you're in a hurry to get somewhere and you're pushing, or because you're, you know, judging other cars, or, you know, what is it that comes into play for you that causes you to lose it? And then when something maybe as simple or trite as, you know, driving, when you start questioning, you start realizing what it is that causes you to lose your ease, then you can question. You start questioning, is it worth it? Is it appropriate? Do you really want to do that? The activity of your mind, the activity that you have to do to lose your ease, is that something that you want to do? Are you willing to do it? Are you willing to sacrifice your ease for getting someplace 30 seconds faster or for, you know, for successfully judging other drivers? You know, is it really worth the cost of sacrificing your ease, the sense of lack of ease that comes? So when you set yourself down to meditation practice, set yourself at ease and then notice what takes you away from that ease. What are the thoughts, the beliefs, what are the feelings, what are the reactions? What is it that arises, that happens? And then question it. Question that. Get to know it, question it. Is it necessary? Can you... And sometimes you'll have some ability to make a choice. You can say, well, that's not worth it. I don't think I have to go that route. I don't have to do that. Sometimes you won't have a choice. Sometimes something will take over. You're sitting there quietly minding your own business and some kind of tension or agitation or strong emotion will arise by itself. And but then, if you can't let go of it easily, then it's really important to study it and get to know it. And it might take minutes, hours, days, weeks to really understand some of the things that, some of the forces inside of us that are arising that cause us to be agitated or causes us to suffer in some way. But to have that as a reference point, ease and loss of ease, ease and loss of ease, is a wonderful reference point for Dharma practice, I think. It's in some ways a simple kind of application of the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, and there's the freedom from suffering. Each of the Four Noble Truths has a responsibility, or has a kind of practice in relationship to it. And the first Noble Truth, suffering, is to know it. The second Noble Truth is to is understand. And the third, understand or to let go of. Understand and let go of the forces of suffering, the craving, the clinging. And the third Noble Truth, the practice around that, is to realize it. So ease, there's a loss of ease, that's a suffering. There's understanding that suffering, understanding what's going on there. What are we clinging to? What are we holding on to? What are we resisting? What's happening in that situation? And then, if it's possible, to have the letting go, the release of that, and perhaps coming back to the place of ease. I think that many people are all too willing to sacrifice their well-being or sacrifice their ease. There's all these things that seem so compellingly important that we don't stay at ease because we, oh, I have to, you know, the stomach contracts, the shoulders get tight, the neck gets tight, the, you know, the mind starts racing or gets caught up or the feelings get aroused, all kinds of feelings. About things which, you know, maybe, you know, are they really that important? I think many people who are not practicing mindfulness will go through their life not examining the small little choices they make that cause them to sacrifice their well-being. So I like the example of driving a car because it's so, to me, it's so, there's so much choice, obviously choice in relationship to how we choose to drive our car. The speed limit we go is our choice. You know, you don't say, you know, the devil made me do it, you know, or, you know, the officer, I'm sorry, but the devil made me do it. You know, it's just, that's, you know, it's your choice. Now there's been two stories of people coming to IMC in the morning. And driving down Farm Hill, there's kind of a speed trap there, if you ever come down Farm Hill. And being stopped for going too fast, and the officer asking, where are you going? And they said that they were going to various things at IMC. And they said, well, okay. One of them was coming to our chaplaincy training program. And the guy said, well, I can't give a ticket to a chaplain. You just drive more carefully, please. And the other one said, oh, I was late for my meditation class. And he said, oh, well, you know, I won't give you a ticket this time, but just please drive mindfully. But, you know, so we have, you know, driving is a place where we have, I would say, obviously a lot of choice. Our relationship to driving, how we feel, the sacrifices we make in our state of mind that come into play because of how we choose to drive. And then to question it, to look at that and question it, is this something you really want to do? Is it worth it? And now if you're going to the emergency for some reason, maybe it's worth it. But most of us are not driving to the emergency. So what is it that's going on something as simple as driving? And now if we can take something as simple as that and exercise our power of choice, exercise our ability to come back to the place of ease, reinforcing the place of ease, then it's really helpful. But if you start doing more and more of those in the small areas of your life that you can where you do have a choice, the cumulative effect has a big impact. And there are huge things, huge forces within us of clinging, of attachment, of all kinds of things that are hard to address directly. Ways in which we lose our ease, ways in which we sacrifice it. But if we start creating a background or a foundation of ease, whatever we can, then we slowly, slowly start getting closer and closer into the core of some of the things that are really hard to do, or creates the conditions and makes it easier to go into the things that are hard to look at and deal with. So for some people, ease means calm. For some people, ease means being, you know, relaxed. For some people, ease means a sense of well-being. For some people, ease might mean having a sense of joy. For some people, you know, can take many different shapes and forms, the idea of ease. But it seems to me it's such a very simple guideline. And my impression is that all of Buddhism can be discovered through that simple little study. Ease and the loss of ease, ease and the loss of ease. And when you find that the ease becomes more pervasive, more regular part of your life, then I think that that gives access to going deeper with ease. So say that there's a scale of ease from 1 to 10, right? And 10 is really good, really, really great ease. And 1 is kind of like, you know, where most people are when they're rushing around. And so say you can get to 2. But if you can get stabilized in 2, then you might be able to peek into 3 sometimes. And then that becomes a new reference point. So meditation practice, I think, is a way of peeking over the edge into a new possibility of ease or well-being or calm or being at peace. And so to have something like meditation practice, it allows you to drop below the usual level that you have and discover new degree of quality, better quality of ease. And then to use that as a reference point to understand what's going on. So as you drop into a deeper sense of peace, or a deeper sense of well-being, maybe through meditation practice, then it gives you a new vantage point to understand how you leave that, how you might sacrifice that. Maybe you never saw the sacrifice or the choices you make, because you're always living at a, you know, maybe you're always living with a certain level of tension or holding or attitudes. But if you can drop below that little bit, then you can see how it gets constructed, how it happens. And also, I'm very fond of the idea of ease, because ease to me, the word ease, is something very simple. It doesn't have a lot of metaphysics to it. It doesn't have a lot of grandiosity to it. It doesn't have a lot of, you know, Hollywood lights around it. You know, some great spiritual goal, you know. It just, you know, it's pretty ordinary, simple. So I think it lends itself to a kind of simplicity of being, which for me is one, I don't know if it's for you, maybe it's different for you, but for me, simplicity of being is one of the real treasures of what the Buddha was pointing towards. Simplicity of being. Not to be, you don't have to be anybody for anybody. You don't have to, you know, identity. You don't have to prove yourself. You don't have to disprove yourself. You don't define yourself or defend yourself. You don't have to, do anything except just be alive and let things happen. So simplicity of being, so much comes out of simplicity of being. And simplicity of being, I think, is very close to a being which is free, to freedom of being. Ease, simplicity of being, freedom of being, to me are very closely connected to each other. Zen teacher who, when he was about, I don't know how old he was, but when he was about, he was an abbot of a monastery. He'd been spent much of his life living in or around the monastery, training there as a new student and kind of going up through the ranks, many years of practice there. And then he became abbot, and he was abbot for a good number of years, and I don't know how old he was, maybe he was 68, 70. And the abbot had all these rules about how you're supposed to be there. Schedules you're supposed to follow and rules of behavior. After he'd been abbot for a number of years and he was, you know, he reached the age of 68, he kind of realized one day he didn't have to follow any of the rules. I mean, they're just man-made, human-made. And he was the abbot. So, you know, he didn't have to be anxious about the schedule, or he didn't have to be anxious about anything. And that was about time you figured it out. you know, it took that long. So it's in some ways, I was very happy for him. You know, it was great. But, you know, it took a long time to realize that the you know, you didn't have to be burdened or be anxious about the rules and regulations of the monastery. So ease and the studying what causes us to lose the ease. I'm not suggesting this is easy, though there are times when it is easy, because I think it, you know, if you really can use this as a little guideline, it'll take you to some of the most difficult places in your psyche, some of the greatest attachments, greatest places of clinging, of holding, of confusion, of identity. And so it might take some real ability to persevere, to hold in there, to look carefully, and hang in there for a long time before you can really penetrate and really see deeply what's what. Maybe because I'm thinking about this Zen teacher, and I was thinking, now I'm thinking of another story of when I was at a Zen student at Green Gulch. They had a Zendo, and in the Zendo there's an altar with a big Buddha statue, and the altar is as you come in from the back, kind of. Imagine you come in through a back door. So you face the back of the altar, and you come to the back of the altar, and then you go either side, and go down either side. The room's divided in half by the altar. And so the altar's here, you come in through the back, and you go like this. And the Buddha is facing that way. And the rule was that you weren't supposed to cross in front of the Buddha, because that's, you know, disrespectful. So if you want to get from one side of the meditation hall to the other, you have to go all the way around the back of it, because I was more polite, right? And there was this imaginary line right down the middle of the meditation hall. And it was kind of like electricity. Because, you know, if you kind of knew when you're getting close to that line. And the closer you got to that line, the more, like, you know, felt kind of like uneasy. Oh, you know, got to be careful with that. And then, you know, so that famous line. I remember feeling, having this relationship with that line. And then one day I was somehow in that meditation hall, off on the side doing something, cleaning or doing something, on an off hours. And some tourists came in to the Green Gulch Zendo just to kind of, you know, check out what a Zen center looks like. And they didn't know anything about the rules of a Zen monastery. They didn't know anything about that line. So they just walked in like it was, you know, like they're walking through, I don't know, Giridelli Square. He was walking in, and they just walked right past that line, right across the front of the altar, as if, you know. And at that moment, it was like this bubble popped in my mind. Oh, it doesn't exist. It's a convention. It's an idea that we've created. And it may be useful, it certainly, you know, has its place, but it's a social convention that we've kind of constructed. And when I saw that as a social convention, I was actually liberated from it. And so I never longer, I tried always still to try not to cross it, you know, try to respect the rule and all that. But I no longer felt anxious about that line. I didn't think that lightning was going to strike, or I didn't know what was supposed to happen. You know, it's a social convention. And so, you know, what I could have done, which I didn't do, was I could have felt the anxiety that arose, the tension that arose as I got closer to that line. And then I could have questioned that. What's that about? Why do I feel that way? Why do I feel, you know, I know there's a rule, but why should I feel tension or anxiety about getting close to that? What does that represent, crossing it? And I probably would have noticed a lot of things. And I don't think it was a fear of lightning. I think if it was a fear, probably would have been fear of disapproval. Fear of being seen as being a bad Zen student, or a wrong Zen student, or disrespectful Zen student, or mindless Zen student, or, you know, all kinds of things. You know, it has to do with self-image and self-identity, and, you know, and the anxiety that got close to, arose as I got close to that line, had to do with all these other things that were arising in me. So if I'd studied that, you know, what is it? Why am I getting anxious? I probably would have seen all those things. And then I could question that, and then I might have even gone back to the teacher and questioned the line. Say, what is the nature of this line? How am I supposed to be holding it? Am I supposed to be holding it as something I feel anxious about? And I don't think they would have said yes. We put that line in the hall so that you'd be anxious when you got close to it. So at some point later, some years later, I was made kind of the head of the meditation hall at Green Gulch. I was like the, what's called the Ina, the I don't know what they call, the director of the meditation hall. And so I had to instruct a lot of people about how to be in the Zendo, how to be in the meditation hall. And so I would tell people, there's a lot of ways in which we do things here. And I would say this, I'd say, once you enter into the meditation hall, you can't do anything wrong. However, there are these ways that we might suggest that you, or might tell you to behave. You can't do it wrong. Because people would go into the meditation, they'd all be so many people, especially new people, would be so nervous, but there's a right and the wrong way, and they're going to get it wrong, and they're going to be, you know, people going to see that, and it's terrible. And I felt that a Buddhist meditation hall should be a place that doesn't add that kind of suffering to people. You know, that's kind of like the whole point is to free people from the suffering. So I would tell people, you can't, when you come in here, you can't do it wrong. However, we might tell you, we might remind you again that actually you do it this way here. But it's not because you're doing it wrong, it's just that we have this way of doing it. And so to be at ease. Be at ease with how things are. What does it take to be at ease with how things are? What does it take not to worry about how things are? What does it take not to live with a world of shoulds concerning what is? What is it to live just to be at ease with how things are? And why not? Why not? And if you ask that question, why not? And you start getting answers. Well, these are reasons why I shouldn't be at ease. I have these important things to do. You don't understand. My whole rest of my life is at stake here. I talked to someone recently who was tormented seemingly tormented between having to make two big decisions that he couldn't decide between. One decision was to go and become a Buddhist monk, and the other was to go and get a PhD in Buddhist studies. Those are those two choices he wanted to, he was looking into. And there's something really ridiculous about being tormented about how you're going to engage in a spiritual practice where the whole purpose of the practice is to free you from torment. You know, it's something, isn't that something? Isn't that quite something? And I know it's really easy for people to suffer because of their Buddhist practice, but it's kind of silly. It's like, you know, the whole point is to, you know, is to help you. The last thing you should do is to have a Buddhist institution or a Buddhist tradition or whatever that somehow it adds suffering to your life. Now, of course, when we go into a Buddhist practice situation, we bring our tendencies with us. So we create suffering all the time. But I think because of the Buddhist institution, I think it's like the reference point of ease, the reference point of not suffering, should always be really close at hand. So we're always ready to start questioning. Why? What's going on here? Why am I doing this? What's happening? Don't just questioning. What's here? What's going on? And, you know, on what authority, what beliefs am I doing this? Am I losing my ease? Why? Question it. Ask the teachers there. So when I was part of Zen Center, I wrote a document the ethical guidelines for living at Zen Center, ethical guidelines for people living at Zen Center. And one of the things I said in the document is that if there's a tension between institutional needs and personal needs, that is an occasion to stop and investigate and look what's going on. Because what I saw too many times in Buddhist institutions is people would, there'd be a tension. In Buddhist institutions sometimes have a way of always wanting to do more activities and do more. There's all these people suffering, right? You want to serve everybody, right? And there's no end to the number of people suffering. And you're supposed to be bodhisattvas, and supposed to sacrifice yourself and just help other people all the time. And is it, you know, institutions like San Francisco Zen Center, the institution doesn't have the capacity to say no. It only has the capacity to ask. And so there was asking and asking and asking and asking of people, and or expecting people to kind of keep offering more and more of their work and labor. And people are really being snowed under, kind of being exhausted from all the demands of the situation. And then there was this feeling, well, the institution is so important. It's this great Buddhist organization, and we're doing most great good in the world, and you know, you should just sacrifice your sense of self, your sense of well-being for the greater good. And I didn't think that was very healthy. So I said that if there's a tension, if you feel a tension between the personal need and the institutional need, that's an occasion to stop and investigate and discuss it, discuss what's going on. It might be appropriate to sacrifice one's own self in some way or other. It might be very beautiful at times. But if there's a tension connected to that, it's really important to stop and look at it. So ease and investigating what it is that causes us to lose that ease. So, I hope that is provocative or useful for you to think about. And help your study of ease and the loss of ease, we'll end a few minutes early. You know, give you a little head start. So you have less reason to rush out of here and rush onto the road to what's next. So thank you.